There are a couple of candles burning over there now for them. But let us also remember that they are not the only victims of imposed devastation faced with a daunting and overwhelming need to start over. For all the people whose lives have been pummeled by the atrocities in Afghanistan, Iraq, Russia, Sudan, let us take into our hearts and minds a fraction of the abundant, overflowing pain they know. They are far away, but anguish knows no bounds. We strengthen our humanity by our willingness to witness, not so much by staying informed, but by staying in touch with the human condition, the human reality of folks who are innocent victims of impersonal forces of destruction. Folks who have before them years of rebuilding to restore the infrastructure of their lives, to reconcile, if possible, with the tragedy and inhumanity they have been dealt. Here, now, considering the time and energy it requires to rebuild lives, we realize more fully, more deeply, and appreciate what a privilege it is to be moving forward with plans for your own growth and learning. I have worked hard and waited and planned for this time of ministry, ministerial internship. I am ready for the new community, the new role, the tasks, the duties which go along with this training in the ministry of liberal religion that you are offering to me. Ministry for me is taking on the work to become oriented to the great mystery which binds us together in this life, to discern the priorities dictated by the affirmation of the sacredness of all living beings. It is living for the sake of soul, mine, yours, and the earth's. Where will it end? We don't know. But it has begun. Something filled with hope has just begun between you and me. Perhaps that is enough blessing for this morning.
Let us be aware of who we really are, not in the small sense, but in the large one. Who are the people? What are the relationships? What are the guiding ideals and values that help define our largest selves? Let us love those people, those relationships, and those ideals as we love ourselves, for in truth, they are our larger self. What high values and ideals have we served in our best and proudest moments? Let us keep those ideals before us always in order that all of our moments have a better chance of being among our best. When we become frightened, we tend to withdraw into our smallest and most scared selves as though just surviving were all we could hope for. But the survival of our smallest and most scared selves isn't what we or our world need. We need the survival of our largest, bravest, and most alive selves. And so let us be aware of who we really are, not in the small sense, but in the largest sense possible. Let us remember who we are and whose we are. And let us be inspired to serve that image of our very largest self, because if we serve it faithfully, we will become what we have served. Amen. When things change and we have to start over, one of our strongest concerns becomes survival, just taking care of ourselves, doing what's best for ourselves, just trying to get through this. There isn't an art to it, and there isn't a science to it, though there's wisdom for it. And the kind of wisdom I think we need is the kind that can counteract our very human and horrid tendency to expect only perfection of ourselves and to beat ourselves up when we handle transitions badly. I think of a poem from a witty, wise poet named Pete Hine, a poem I've loved for 40 years. It's a little thing called The Road to Wisdom. The road to wisdom, well, it's plain and easy to express. Just air and air and air again, but less and less and less. I think that's a better companion for trips through change than the perfectionist agenda that would let us beat ourselves up every time something changes and every time we have to change and grow. It's another great chance and excuse to err and err and err again in the hope and the faith that it will be less and less and less, and at the end, we're wiser. At first glance, it might not sound like a religious issue. It just might sound like we need a trip to the self-help section of the bookstore. But I think at second glance, it is a religious issue, because one concern of almost every religion that I'm aware of, and the key concern when things are tough and we have to change and go through some changes and start over, the key concern is just who and what this self is that we're trying to save and trying to survive with. And the biggest mistake we make, if all the world's religions are to be believed, is that we tend to define ourselves when we get scared in too small and too narrow a way. And doing that takes away from us all the power and support and foundation that we need. It's a vicious circle. So I want to talk about a happier circle today, because it can work both ways. And the answer is as hard as it is easy. And that's understanding just how big our real selves are. I first started thinking about it this way from an idea I got from a very unusual source. It was a book that I can still hardly believe I ever read, a title no one would pick off the shelf. The title was 13th Century Chinese Neo-Confucianism. I was at a conference, and I don't remember what we were talking about. We were talking about something at a conference at the University of Chicago probably a dozen years ago. And after I'd taken part in something, some panel discussion or something, some man came forward very agitated to me, and he said, "You need to read my book." And I thought, not another one. This room is full of people like you. Go away. And I said, why do I need to read your book? And he said, "It's what you're talking about. You need to read my book." And he was fumbling for a card and gave me a business card. And he said, "Call my secretary." He said, "She'll send you one." And I said, "What is this? Who are you? What's your book about?" And he said, "I'm a classicist." He said, "I work with medieval Chinese Neo-Confucianism." And he said, "Just call my secretary. She'll send you the book." And I thought, all right, the upside is I get a free book. That's okay. So I did call her secretary. He was retired from Columbia. And she said, "Oh, yes, Professor DeBerry told me you'd be calling, and just give me your address, and I'll send the book." And she did, with a bill for $35. Now, I thought maybe that's the only lesson there was to learn here. But $35 is a lot of money to pay for a little book that you didn't know you wanted. And so I decided I better read it. And It was really an astonishing book, even after all that. He was right. The problems that we're struggling with today, with identity and self and so forth, were absolutely the problems that 13th century Chinese Neo-Confucian thinkers were working with. It was amazing. And what they taught people to do, this was their guiding principle for teaching people how to live. They said, one must always live for one's self. Now that sounds so modern, it sounds like 21st century American narcissism. What they did with it, and they wouldn't back off from it, they said, absolutely, you must live for yourself. And of course the key word was self. And if you know Confucians, what they did with this is to say, you must live for yourself because all the strength you need is in yourself, but you have to find the right self. And it certainly isn't just the little scared you. If you had all the strength you needed, you wouldn't be so scared or so small. It's your whole self, your real self you have to find. And they went on then to explain, as Confucians do, that yourself is all the interactions and relationships you have with all the people around you. It's that social web of connections and family and friends and all that, they said, that's yourself. And you need to live for yourself. Well, this changes everything. And now you're not alone. Now it's a bigger self. Now the problems aren't so scary. It's a wonderful trick. I think every religion has some way of saying this. And I like saying it in different ways. Christians have another way of saying it, and I love it too. And Christians will sometimes say, it's not who we are, but whose we are. That's the same kind of message. And what they mean, of course, is that we need to remember that we're children of God. We're God's children. God is our Father. God loves us. God affirms us. God accepts us. Boy, is there power there. And then having this power and this great, huge identity, now it's easier to know what to do and how to change, because we're not just acting for our little scared selves. We're acting for someone who is a child of God and needs to live in ways that honor that wonderful, divine kind of parentage. It's wonderful stuff. There's some other pictures I want to offer you. I'll come back to this whose we are, child of God thing in a minute. But there are other pictures from the Greeks, the ancient Greeks, some of my favorite people. And they had so many pictures for everything. They had all the gods and goddesses you want, unless you want an infinite number, and then you go to the Hindus. But the Greeks started out with a dozen, over 3,000 years ago. They started out with a dozen, six men and six women. Most people don't know that. And then later on, they added another woman to it. So they had 13. But around the time of the Golden Age of Greece, Socrates and Plato and Aristotle, the gods were kind of fading out, and they were coming up with pictures to live by that didn't involve gods. And one of those, while I like all their gods and goddesses too, I think they're wonderful pictures of psychological dynamics, natural dynamics. They're kind of ways of seeing the complexity of who we are and how our world is. But they had another picture that was a wonderful picture, and I'm not sure where it came from. It was a picture of the soul. The Greeks invented the soul. You need to know that. The Christians took the notion of the soul from the Greeks, but the Greeks invented it. It took them 200 years. From about the 6th to the 4th century B.C., they went through 200 years where they were trying to struggle to come up with a word and a concept for what is most essential and fundamental about a human. And they had mind was one idea they came up with, and spirit, and breath of life, and all this kind of stuff. But finally it was psyche, the soul, and the notion that it's not a little bag of air or anything like that. It's the notion that the soul is that concept that's what's most essential and fundamental about us, and that's what we need to honor and live for. And they had a picture of the soul that's one of my very favorite ever. And they picture the soul, who was always feminine for the Greeks. Psyche was female. They picture the soul as a spider in the middle of a web, and the rays of the web are all of the connections that connect that spider to her whole big world. It's everything that supports her. And her days are spent, in this picture, mending the web. and attending to the connections that hold her to the bigger world. That's living for oneself, where oneself has all these connections that have to be mended over and over and over again. It's a wonderful picture. You can go back, I want to go back to that theistic image of the who we are and whose we are. I know that there are people in this room for whom that will sound spooky, whose we are. And you think, it sounds like a critter, and I'm not interested in critters. So then you tune it out. I want to unspookify. It's a theological term. I want to unspookify this because it's not spooky at all, and it's really a neat idea. For instance, some of you speak of reason in a way that lets me know when I hear you talk that you've capitalized the word when you've pronounced it. You want to live a life according to reason. The nation should run according to reason. Everything should run according to reason. It should be rational. Well, this is a good thing. Now, what it tells me is you're a child of reason. That's your parentage. And when you get stuck, whose you are reason's child. And so you check with that bigger identity and say, does this make sense? Is this rational? Is this the reasonable thing to do? And it gives you power and a place to stand and more courage to go forward. That's how that works. Others here wouldn't go to reason as your bigger community. You might speak, as Buddhists do, of compassion. I think one of the Buddhist teachings that's one of the most exciting and tantalizing and hard in the world and wonderful is their teaching that when we're faced with the choice between doing the right thing or doing the compassionate thing, I love these paradoxes, we should always choose the compassionate thing because that's the right thing. Isn't that nice? So these people now are children of compassion. In Buddhist imagery, perhaps they're children of Kuan Yin, the goddess who's sort of Buddha's feminine counterpart and the goddess of compassion. And that's whose they are. And you see how much bigger it makes you when you're stuck? Now you have Kuan Yin to help you and the Buddha and a whole tradition of people. Or you may think, as a lot of you do, in naturalistic terms. You don't read a lot of Buddhism. It's probably been years since you read a book on 13th century Neo-Confucianism. I have one I'll sell you for $35. And you think in terms of nature instead. And you say, I don't need any of this stuff. I can go out to the woods and I'm home. I'm in the middle of home. Well, now I know whose you are. Your Mother Earth's. Your Mother Nature's. And that's a good thing too. And then when you check what you're doing and where you're going and what your decisions are, you'll find that you'll be checking to say, does this honor Mother Earth? Does this respect her treasures rather than trample or destroy them? You see what you can get from this? You can get a whole world of power and wisdom and insight, not from who you are, but from whose you are. It's wonderful. And that picture of nature's picture reminds me of one of my favorites. It doesn't come from religion or philosophy or anything, though it's pretty natural. It's the story, it's a fishy story, it's the story of koi, those decorative carp that Japanese raise and that you see sometimes quite big in ponds. And what I read about koi, I don't know if this is true of all other fish or not, I'll stick with koi. What I've read about koi is that how big the fish gets is directly related to how big the tank it's growing in. You put a koi in a small fish tank and it's never going to get much bigger than this. You put the same fish in a huge aquarium, it can get this long. Put it in a small pond, you're talking a pretty big koi. Put it in a large pond or a lake, you can get a fish this long. It's the same fish. Who it is determined directly by whose it is. How big it is determined directly by the size of the world with which it's able to maintain connections. That isn't poetry. It's a little fishy, but it's science. It's true. And we're like koi. The bigger our world is and the more connections we have, the bigger we become and the more strength and power and peace we have to draw from. So we're always starting over. And when things change, which is every day, and when we have to start over, which is also every day, let us be sure to live for ourselves and to take care of ourselves, but our whole self. Let us live for and take care of our whole self. No one smaller than that.